John Lennon, also really like your Harley shirt. Good job, Rod. Good morning. Welcome to the West Valley Center for Spiritual Living. I'm Reverend Karen Rice, and I am the spiritual leader of this community, and I'm very happy that you are all here to join us today. And I also think it's good to know that I'm not the only one. You know, that's the line in that song that always grabs me. It's like so... We can feel like we sort of live on an island with our desire to see the world be a better place, and we're not. We're never the only one. So I have something interesting to chat about this morning, and if you noticed the title of the message, it's about rewriting the Ten Commandments. So that was very clever of you to pull that and have that, what was it, a Decalogue? Because we're going to talk a little bit about what that means. And I have to confess, I did not make up the title. I took it from an old-time religious science minister, Dr. J. Kennedy Schultz. Reverend Cheryl must be here. I'm so glad you're here, Reverend Cheryl. you're gonna enjoy this. And Dr. Kennedy Schultz was a wild one, that one. I didn't know anything about him, but he founded a church in Atlanta, Georgia in the 80s. He was around a while. He's not living any longer. But he was known, apparently, when I Googled him, he was known for saying some pretty funny things. Like, he said things like, "For God so loved the world, he didn't send a committee." Perfect for a board meeting day, I'm just going to say. But this one is the one I really like. God loves the atheists best because they never fell for any of that BS. So he must have been really fun. Did you ever meet him, Cheryl? Oh, I'm so jealous. I covet thy good. So we're looking today at some conversation that came through Dr. Kennedy. He wrote this fun little book called You Are the Power, and every now and then I dive into it because it's so filled with principle and it's so science of mind, it's really easy to use. So he had this idea that the Ten Commandments are indeed very valuable, just as all of the Old Testament has value, the Bible has value, and all religions have value. Don't we say that every Sunday? And that is a part of our faith, how we're based. We honor all paths. But he did say that the problem is that sometimes we have too much focus on the thou shalt nots. And that with that negative approach, we miss other things that are possible. So we're going to look this morning, I'm going to focus on turning those thou shalt nots into a positive direction for us. And I know he would be really happy with this message, because when you look at the Ten Commandments that are found in the book of Deuteronomy, you would find all those: thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not lie, and then all those covets. Thou shalt not covet, a whole long list of things. Here, I've prepared a list for you. Thou shalt not covet, meaning envy or lust after. Your neighbor's house, your neighbor's car, your neighbor's shiny RV sitting in their driveway, your neighbor's really long, really cool vacation, Sue Witter, your neighbor's maid, your neighbor's gardener or landscaper. You should not covet your neighbor's wife or your neighbor's donkey. They really said that. So as I was playing with this and I was looking at all the thou not, what are the things that we shouldn't covet, I thought, wow, that sounds more like a bucket list to me. Most of the things on that list are things that many of us would hope to accomplish while we're here, or at least we enjoy dreaming about. So the whole point of coveting is where you want something that belongs to somebody else. And I'm just going to tell you right now, the value of this message today is that there is another way to perceive all of that. That surely we look at things and we have desires to acquire stuff or conditions or situations in our life. And so when you look at what somebody else wants, there's a different way of noticing that that's just a desire in your own heart. And so we can notice those desires and be happy for practice. We can maybe practice instead of coveting, being happy for their good fortune and imagining what would it be like to have that shiny motorhome in my driveway or to take that 3-week vacation and do all those wonderful things that you get to do on those long extended times away. And then when you begin to feel that gratitude, we now are activating something in that universal law of all the universe that is not blocking the flow of our good toward our own life. So there's a little clever way we can look at those things and change that covet into deep appreciation for what's possible. So we can't make our lives better. We cannot make this world better by trying to not do something that we have an urge to do. So if we look at it and turn it around and sort of take the evil out of it, rewrite the Ten Commandments, you might say, we can begin to use these desires as sort of a part of our spiritual practice that does not involve coveting. There's a reason there, you shalt not covet, right? It doesn't bring goodness into our life to do that. It rather is focusing on lack instead of the pure potential of what it would be like to have those desires fulfilled in our life. And I just want to say that, be really clear here, I'm really not talking about acquiring things. We're really always going back to the truth of what's behind that desire, which is always, if you are attentive to it, it will demonstrate some quality of God. And that's where the real stuff is. So Dr. Kennedy says that when the Bible says your salvation is at hand, that this is kind of what we're talking about. It's not that you can't have all that. All of those things that you desire to have, your salvation, he's using this term, he says it shows us that it is at hand. It's as close to you as your own hand, or you could say within your reach. So notice we're not talking about being saved from anything as much as we are talking about shifting our belief around what that means to have a desire. So it's not, Lord, please save me from my evil ways because I see that I long for some of those things, but rather recognize what divine quality do those things represent in your own life, and then open yourself to receive that goodness. And we never know how that might come. You know, it's so intriguing to me that I meet people that say things like, one day when I win the lottery, I'm going to go to Hawaii. Well, maybe there are other ways to get there, you know, other things that could shift and change in your life. So we want to broaden it out. It's one of those stories where we don't want to tell God how to do it. Let's just keep your heart on what that represents to you. So it's always within our reach. In fact, all of that potentiality is always at the center of our life. I loved the name change for our organization, Centers for Spiritual Living. So we become a that which is in the very center of that pure potentiality. And so each of us really is, in terms of our own living, we are a center for spiritual living as we stand in the middle of this great truth. So there's this amazing, this is what we're going to talk about. This is what I'm excited about. There's this amazing sort of God stuff that we are made of. And there is this creative nature that we inherit from the great creator. You might say, if you use that image of sons and daughters of the divine or created in the image and likeness of, that we then have that same God stuff in us. And that is what our teaching is about. the theories, the teachings, the philosophy of the science of mind are all about the way we can tap into the power that is already ours, already at hand, already ours, and at the center of our own life. And then we can begin to create experiences in our life that we desire. And as we look at this way of sort of directing that power, we see that we really have it all along. We've always had it. But it is the power that lives in our mind through our thoughts. Now, I want to talk to you about that. That'll make more sense to you as I get to the deeper into this message today. Ernest Holmes, the founder of this philosophy, the guy that had the vision to see that there were strands of truth in all religious teachings and traditions, he said so frequently, you know, I read Holmes a lot, and I see again and again that he tells us that there's nothing in the world that cannot be improved upon. There is no area of our life that we can't enhance in some way. And in fact, every day of our life is about growing and expanding what's possible in our life. Now, it is true that we absolutely teach that you must start at the beginning, and the beginning is being grateful for what is. Right? So as we develop sort of spiritual maturity, we begin to see that it's not about the ways we're hard on ourselves and we feel not good enough, or we feel we don't have good self-worth, but that it's actually flipping that around so that we can just be grateful, because it is gratitude that attracts more of that positive thinking, energy, ideas. And as we begin to think that way, everything shifts and moves and changes, not only in our physical being, but in our physical life as well. So not only is there nothing in the world that cannot be better than it is already, but I notice that the things that I desire now, I might not even want in 5 years in my life anymore. Have you cleaned a closet lately? You know, we always are growing. I might change my mind about some of my greatest desires in 5 minutes, because that's the way life is. It's designed to be that way, that constant movement and that constant expansion in consciousness and in all ways that impacts our personal lives. But we also know that there is nothing so sacred that it needs to stand forever because of tradition. You know, Emerson said, nothing is at last sacred but the integrity of your own mind. Nothing. See, nothing is so sacred. Nothing is that big but the integrity of your own mind. And so it's very important for us to pay attention to being authentic to those ways in which we are called to show up in this lifetime, in this body, in our relationships and all of that. But nothing is so sacred that it doesn't mean traditions don't have to change. And as soon as I read that, I thought, you know, we used to have this fun Christmas tradition, and then our kids started getting married, and our grandkids started coming into the world, and there came a point where there were so many of us that we hardly fit in a room anymore, and nobody really wanted to spend all that money buying everybody a gift. You know, it became burdensome instead of joyful, and it was difficult to change that tradition. It was difficult, but we set an intention, and over time, we were able to find a new way to do that. And so I think that in many ways is likely to be what the world is moving through right now. Some of the discontent that we're seeing, and as we know, as I speak about regularly, that can be a good thing. Change can be good, and sometimes change isn't ushered in until we really let go of the old and it has to break apart to fall away, and maybe that's what we're seeing now in some ways. So everything we talk about here is about being open to that change, being open to that expansive nature of life and consciousness, and enlarging sort of our container. You know, how receptive are you to receive your good? You know, so we're always talking about making that larger so we can envision our life changing. And maybe even just sometimes the greatest change I have experienced is in the act of surrender, where I don't know what it is I want or need, and I sort of step out of my own way and then allow something bigger to emerge. And the way I experience that is that great old idea of thy will be done, not my will. You know, like the divine imagination is so much greater than mine is that sometimes that's the way I stretch myself and I start imagining, so what good would God want in my life? And now you can think way out of the box, way out of your checkbook or way out of the neighborhood you live in or whatever it is. And sometimes those things don't even have to change for a big change to make it feel like all of that has changed. Because when we change, all of that changes. Do you ever go through change and then try and think back how it used to be and you can't even remember it? Right? It just changes, and then you're standing there right in the middle of new. So here's the deal. Most of us, even here in this room where we talk this way and we believe this stuff, we come to be inspired again over it, most of us still live our lives too small. It's so interesting. And yet, each and every one of us, each of us is... Think of this. This is kind of mind-boggling. Each of and every one of us is the means by which God comes into this world. Now, I want to talk about that because that's a little hard to wrap your mind around sometimes. I can get like, oh, God's love won't be expressed on this planet if I don't express love because God wants to express that through me. But I want to talk to you today about this idea in a deeper way, in a much more personal way. So see if you can take a breath here and open your minds and soften your hearts a little bit to really hear this. I'm reading a new book, Nancy Noel. You need to read this book if you haven't. Where's Nancy? You have to read this book. You probably already have it. It's called The God Theory by Bernard Haysch. So some of you are reading this book. I cannot remember how it came into my life, but it's called The God Theory by Bernard Haysch, and Bernard, H-A-I-S-C-H. He's an astrophysicist. However, he's also a Catholic seminarian. You know, God bless. Don't you love those Franciscan monks? I don't know what they do there. I want to be a Franciscan monk because you don't come out of there, you know, without this. They got the whole package, man. They get mysticism and they get practical stuff for the world that we can use. So this gentleman wrote a fabulous book called The God Theory. And he has one of my favorite so far, because, you know, science and spirituality was my hardest class in seminary, or a series of classes. And he blends science and spirit really, really well. And he says that consciousness is more than brain chemistry. But we believe that. We teach that. All the authors that are writing about science and spirituality now are saying the same thing, that consciousness is more than brain chemistry. And Haysch has something very interesting to say on his theory of how all life came to be. You know, sort of the creation story that every religion has their own version of how life came to be and how to interpret those 7 days you know, the Native Americans, the indigenous tribes have their story. Everybody has their own story on how life came to be. So Haysch has this segment in the book where he talks about the work of Isaac Newton. And Isaac Newton, the story I want to share with you this morning, was 22 years old, and he was attending school. He was going to Cambridge University in England, and he had this. He was probably one of those geeky guys that had all kinds of great ideas and wanted to prove stuff. And it was a bright, sunny day. So he drilled a hole in one of the shutters that covered his windows. He drilled a little hole in it, and he closed the shutters so that the room was darkened, and a beam of light, because the sun was just certain, that the beam of light went through the hole in the shutters and shined on the wall. And then he went and he got a prism. So he got a piece of glass that was cut, like a crystal that had several sides to it or whatever. He got a prism, and he put the prism in front of the beam of light, and what shined up on the wall?
Rainbow.
A rainbow. So he looks at the rainbow, and he sees that the colors come in a very specific order. Red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, and violet is how he identified them. I always want to sing the song. Red, orange, yellow, green, blue. What's that? No?
Oh, no. Is
it? Okay. And that's cute. So we all have our own little way of remembering it. And the thing is that we all know it's more than seven colors, because every color, it's actually an infinite, unnameable number of colors, because each color fades and blends into the next color, and so it just gets, the closer you look, the greater it gets. And what we know about color, now I have to confess, I did not know this, and I'm going to guess many of you do, but that what makes the purest white light is when all those colors are mixed together. So what happens is, what Newton discovered is that each color moved through the prism in a very different way, at a different speed and a different wavelength, and created a different position in the way he saw the rainbow on the wall. And we also know that's very predictable. So the prism becomes a refractive device that separates the colors. And the reason this is relevant is because we use it in our life. Now, I'm going to tie it spiritually together in just a moment, but if I wanted, for instance, to put a red dot on that wall, I would need a device that would take the colors and filter out all the other colors so that only the red light could get through. And then we could see a red light there. Let me tell you something even simpler than that. Not that I think this is simple. You don't know how many times I said to my husband, please, would you explain it to me one more time? The other illustration that Bernard Haish gives in the book is that if how many of you had slideshows, took slides in the 70s and the 80s, and now you have racks of slides somewhere that we hope to get transferred one day, and we have about a 5-year gap in our picture albums from all those times we took slides. But when you're looking at a slideshow, and we used to, in California, we would sit out on the front lawn. We had a white garage door, and so sometimes we would, on a hot night, we would sit out there, and we would do a slideshow on the garage door, and so all the grandkids are over, and we're showing slides from when their parents were little, and you're looking at your vacation, let's say, and you're looking at a beautiful green meadow right at the edge of the ocean. Well, all the green, the slide itself now, has been created to be that which filters out every other color where the green meadow is. And where the blue ocean is, it filters out every other color but the blue, so that we can see the blue ocean. So you have to block everything else or remove it, take it away. And there is this way. It's sort of a complex filtering and a way they focus the lens and all of that. But every point on a little slide then, if we're watching a slideshow on the garage door or anywhere else, every point on the slide acts like a filter for something else. Something is made evident by subtracting something else. And what's left is all you see. Now, in science, they call this creation by subtraction. Think of that. It's a scientific idea. The white light itself is a source of infinite color, and yet by blocking or taking away, we see specific colors. Now, Haish uses this illustration to say that we are creating our lives in the very same process. The experiences that we create in our life come from intelligent subtraction, although sometimes I think that some of the experiences I go through were not intelligent. Might be the opposite of intelligent. But I think what they're saying here is it's choice. It's choice. And when we're conscious, when we're aware, we will make choices that might be better than choices when we're not aware, when we're just moving through life and letting things happen in our life. So we cause things to emerge in our experience by subtracting other possibilities. Now, if we look at white light as a metaphor, and that's a great spiritual metaphor, we use that term a lot, we can see that it's a metaphor for limitless potential. And we can then see that the possibilities for our life, just in the same way there's endless possibilities for the color, the possibilities, the full potentiality for good in our life is already here. It's like it's all sort of bundled together in the same way all the colors are bundled in the white light. So we, by living our life and making the choices we make in our life, are creating the prism through which things are filtered out. We narrow what's possible in our life every time we choose something that we want to experience, or we don't choose, and then we move through an experience that we reap the consequences of anyway because we didn't choose. So think about what this means. In every choice we make, all our lifestyle choices, how you treat your body, how much sleep we get, what kind of food we put into our body, in the ways in which we choose our beliefs, what we're going to believe, and when we're ready to change a belief, can you let go of that old belief and step into a new, a higher way of looking at something? In the way that we use our time, simply in the way you could choose whether you want to read now or do you want to watch TV now, and then the choice of what will I read or what will I watch on TV. We are always making these choices, even how we think about what's going on in the world, the judgments we have about people that don't look quite like we do or act in a way that we expect people should act. In all of that, in our relationships, we are constantly making these choices. And every choice we make is a selective limitation of an infinite potential. It's not good or bad. It's just a choice. We are making a selection. Now, let me go back to Bernard Haish, who, remember now, is an astrophysicist and a seminarian. He has a theory, his own theory, on that idea of creation, on how all physical form came to be on the planet. And I want to read his words for you to hear what he has to say about it. We can conclude that our physical universe comes about when the Godhead, interesting term. We can conclude that our physical universe comes about when the Godhead selectively limits itself, taking the role of the creator, manifesting a realm of space and time, filtering out some of its own potential. Right? So we're the God stuff that has been chosen. We're just not all the God stuff. But we exist with the full potential of experiencing anything that is a part of the God stuff, because that's a part of who we are. The full potential is always there. So it's not, I love that. I love that thought. He says the Godhead selectively limits itself, that conscious intelligent subtraction. What do we filter out to create form? And whoosh, there it is. So it's not a mistake. It's not an accident. It's not random. I like that idea that it's intelligent subtraction. He also says that the individual consciousness comes about through the same process. He says that our minds, this part is so good, I love this. He says that our minds are filtered from the thoughts of God. So when you hear me say that divine imagination is going to be far grander than anything I could imagine, what I'm saying is the thoughts of God are always there. We can reach up and tap into any piece of intelligence at any time. We can't have it all in finite form, but none of it is limited from us. None of it is not given. It is the grace of God to be constantly pouring the full potential into our lives, and we are the ones selecting. We are the ones subtracting. We are the ones filtering what we have and what we see and what we choose. So we can take as much as we can, which is why we always want to stretch our potential, because there's always more. There's always more, as close as your hand, within our reach, because it is in us, expressing as us, God expressing through us, and we are one, how did Renee say it? Not one with it. I'm going to say one with it, because you know what I mean. She had a better way of saying it that I can't recall. Apparently, neither can you. That shoe is powerful. So we are. So what I'm saying is, if I'm having a thought that I'm not happy about, and I'd like to clear it away, then I can release that thought, and I can consciously direct my attention in another way, and grab a higher thought, because all the thoughts in the divine imagination are right there within my reach, all of them. It is about us being conscious, and we have that. So I think Dr. Kennedy had this great idea when he talked about rewriting the Ten Commandments and sort of changing them around. He said, you know, the funny thing is, we've never really obeyed all those commandments anyhow. Right? And instead, we could create a lot more positive possibility in the way we set guidelines for ourselves and the way we look for direction in the spiritual path. And so I was thinking about that, and I thought, you know, the truth is that most of us don't need to be told what the difference is between right and wrong. You know, we learn that as children. And a lot of that we learn by consequence of not making a higher choice, a better choice. And we don't really need anybody, most of us, do not need people to tell us not to cheat or to lie or to kill. There's something in us that intuitively knows those things, and those choices do not take us in the direction that's going to invite more good into our lives. I don't think we get into trouble because we don't know what not to do. I think we get into trouble because we get confused, because we can't figure out how to get the good we desire, the good that we feel inside of us, the urge we have to experience peace and beauty and love in our lives. We just don't know how to get there sometimes. And that's why people make bad decisions. They're just trying to get their good, just like everybody else. So I think we only get into trouble when we don't know how to go about grabbing at that infinite potential or releasing it from within us so that we might have the experience of it I'm teaching Emma Curtis Hopkins on Wednesday evenings, and I'm just guessing you all can feel the vibration coming from that class because amazing things are happening in there. But Emma says, there is a good for me, and I ought to have it. Say that with me. There is a good for me, and I ought to have it. One more time. There is a good for me, and I ought to have it. Are you willing to have more? If not, buy the CD or go home and listen to it on the thing. And listen again because you're entitled to more. We're all entitled to more. I love that idea that right where I am in my life, everything that has unfolded in my life, good or bad, what challenge or beauty and grace and ease, doesn't matter what it is. Everything in my life has brought me to this very moment. And you too. And there is more. There is always more. So trust that instinct when you feel those desires. Those are the moments to be grateful, to feel that gratitude within you, that you can witness that good in somebody else, but that you too are equally as entitled to experience any amount of good that you can receive. It's a matter of putting ourselves in a receptive posture. Our spiritual work is like finding the refractive device that filters out everything we don't want so we can project on the screen of our lives what it is that we do desire. So take a breath. And let's just put some substance into these words by turning to prayer now. So get comfortable where you're seated. Just feel the love of God in this room. The movement of good. The flow of beauty. The revealing of truth. Just feel the love of God at the core of your being right now. For it is a presence and a power for good. And we can call on it, we can use it, we can have that experience of full goodness in our lives. Because all of that potential already exists in our being, and we are absolutely unified with it already. And so I feel the love of God. I feel that activity of life within me. It is that which stirs us to feel the essence of goodness in this universe, those things we have yet to even notice, and to step into a place of deep, deep gratitude, and to feel grateful for all that is. And for all that is yet to come. I feel the love of God, and I know it is the most powerful force in all of the universe. It is that movement of life that heals and reveals and restores us to that perfection that is already in every cell of our body, that intelligence that keeps all things in this beautiful universe in perfect order. And so as I recognize that each of us stands in our own place as individual expressions, divine, beautiful, perfect expressions of life and of God, I know that we are that God stuff. And therefore, there is an intelligence in our body that knows how to heal that which ails us, to restore us to perfect health as we align ourselves to that vibration, as we subtract away, as we take away intelligently, and by choice anything in our life that we no longer desire. And so I feel that peace. I feel that goodness, that absolute balance, the beautiful divine flow of life moving through this room, establishing the well-being of this community and every person connected to it. And so I know in every way, in ways we can see and in ways we have not yet recognized, in every way, we are healing our relationships. We are healing our health, our physical bodies. We are healing our finances. We are healing and wholing our lives because we return to truth today. We filter out anything that does not belong, that we do not desire. We rewrite our own commandments so that we might stand in truth, open to a greater potential, and experience life as the divine desires to experience it through us. And so I say thank you, God. Thank you, God. Thank you, life. Thank you, infinite spirit, for all of these gifts, for all the gifts yet to come, for the imagined and the unimagined good. For we are worthy. We are divine children of a loving, giving creator, and therefore it is good already. I release these words into that divine law that always responds affirmatively, yes, my child, yes, I let it be, and together we say, and so it is.